This is Inman's Real Estate Radio, where we go behind the scenes with the industry's movers and shakers to learn what's next for real estate. For more insight, news, and analysis, visit Inman.com. Here's your host, Bernice Ross.
Welcome. I'm Bernice Ross, the CEO of RealEstateCoach.com, and we're delighted to have Tim Burrell with us. He is a real estate agent in Raleigh, North Carolina with RE/MAX United, and he is also the author of probably the best real estate negotiation book that I've read called Create a Great Deal. Tim, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. So let's begin. What steps do you need to take when you first start working with a client or another agent in order to determine how best to work with that person? Most of us don't do that. We just jump in.
And that's exactly right. The very first thing you've got to figure out is who you're working with, how they work, and how you're going to negotiate. The first part of who you're working with is getting easier and easier in this internet age. You go into Google, you look up their Facebook page, you go into Instagram, you go into Twitter, you can get all kinds of information about who it is. Particularly, I like to know the principals. You know, if I'm working on behalf of a particular seller and a buyer makes an offer, I want to know who that buyer is, but I also want to research the agent. So first of all, knowledge is power. The very first thing you have to do is do some homework. Second part of knowledge is going over how they think, how you're going to communicate with them. A lot of people use the DISC personality profile, the D being dominant, the people that they see the big picture, but they want to get right to it. Give them three bullet points and you're doing great. The influences, influencing people, the I, are the ones that are enthusiastic, optimistic, and collaborative. They also are very influenced by who else did a particular item. So if you can show them that somebody else that they admire did something, it's much easier to convince them. The S is steady. They are people that they're calm, more conservative, more patient, but they're very afraid of loss. They don't want to have anything that really rocks the boat. And the C's are the cautious type or compliant. If you visualize a CPA or an engineer, very buttoned down, very organized, a number of realtors are not particularly fond of those folks because they ask a tremendous amount of detail to make a decision. I happen to really like those folks because once they make a decision, they are going to comply. They are going to follow that contract very specifically. But so there you've got the initial, who is this? What's their personality type? So how am I going to communicate with them? But the most important thing, and this is what the vast majority of realtors don't do, is to figure out what style of negotiating you're going to use. There are, well, if you call it win-win, that's one of the names. I call it collaborative. And it's a way where you can work together, exchange information, and make the deal better. The other version is called win-lose, competitive, confrontational. That's the situation where, well, basically, my gain is your pain. If I take something, you get less and I don't get anything more. So the best thing that you need to do is to find out how the other person negotiates. And this is very disappointing for most of we realtors because the person who is going to set the tone for the negotiations is the other person. You got to find out, well, I use an analogy to dancing. You got to find out how they dance. And you have to adapt your dancing technique to theirs. So if they're going to be somebody who plays all their cards very close to their vest, will not share information with you, and will not exchange items to let you know what's most important to their client, then you have to do the same. If instead you can test things out by trying out with a little bit of information that's not that important. One of my favorites is having to do with personal property. You know, whether they want the washer, dryer, or fridge. Something that if you give it away, it's not going to hurt you. And so test it out and see what response you get. If you get a lot of collaboration, then go with it. The reason you're looking for collaboration is it makes a total difference in the entire process. If they will share what's important to their client with you, and you share what's important to your client with them, then you can trade the different deal points so that the person who values a particular part of the deal the most gets that deal point. And when somebody in a negotiation gets what's critically important to them, they go through the rest of the process and they close fairly gracefully. So huge thing at the beginning of a negotiating process, how are you going to dance? Are you going to be collaborative or are you going to be competitive?
Tim, you have a great example from one of your clients about how the collaborative process works. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Sam and Richard, they're selling their house in Wake Forest. They're moving to Chapel Hill. They're having a house built in Chapel Hill. Sam is scared to death that she's going to be paying two mortgages. That's the biggest point to her. Price, yeah, it'd be nice. But the biggest point is, I want this place sold. Second thing she'd like to have is to not have to move twice and to be able to rent the property back. So we happened to get a buyer coming down from New Jersey who didn't really need to move very quickly. He was going to be retiring here. He was looking for properties, eventually going to use it for an investment for a while, and his closing date was not that critical to him. But this was a number of years ago when the market was rather soft, and since he knew it was a buyer's market, he wanted to have a really good deal. So I was able to collaborate with the other agent and find out what was the most critical thing for him. And frankly, a lot of times it's obvious somebody wants a really good price. But then when I found out the why of his other points, then I could use it to Sam and Richard's advantage. So what we did is to close the sale very soon. So Sam and Richard have the absolute certainty they're never going to pay two mortgages. We also were able to rent the property back from this gentleman because, frankly, he was looking at it as an investment property. So that's an advantage to him to not have it be vacant when he's already paying on a mortgage. As an integral part of this, we managed to negotiate a very favorable rental rate, I think partly because the other agent didn't do rentals. But over the course of the transaction, the period of time that the house was being built, Sam and Richard made up a lot for the advantage on the price that they gave him. So he got a screaming good price, but they didn't have to move twice, which saved them money. They got a really good rent, which saved them money. And they got the emotional satisfaction and the certainty that says, I don't have to sit here and worry about making two mortgage payments and then dropping my price and dropping my property price when am I property doesn't sell. So that's how you use collaborative negotiations. We find out from the buyer what was important to them. I knew from the seller what's important on my side. We traded off the different deal points and everybody came out better. The old analogy is what you're doing is in win-lose negotiating, you have a fixed size of a pie and you're just cutting it up. So if I get more, you get less. In win-win negotiating or collaborative negotiating, you can increase the size of the pie because each party values different deal points differently. And so if the person who values something more gets that item, there's more value to them. So you've increased the value of your overall deal and increased the size of the pie.
Now, let's go on to talk about some of the specific things that you suggest in your book. And one of them is to have a game plan. How can our listeners go about doing that for their businesses?
You know, it's like a football game. It's not over on the first play. You're going to have a whole series of plays to go through the entire process. And so you have to, first of all, set the expectations. That's one of the biggest things in negotiations. If people get what they expect and what they thought they were entitled to, they're happy. Good analogy on this one is repairs. Always comes up. And so at the very beginning of the process, you are dealing with your sellers and you're talking with them about the price, and you tell them that they are going to pay a certain amount of money on repairs. In my area, I typically tell people it's going to be someplace in the general vicinity of 1% of their price. And so just count on that. Then, you know, if you negotiate the initial price, you negotiate through the things, they do their inspection, you've got your people prepared that the next time around is going to come up with a request for negotiation, if I may, request for repairs. And at that stage, they are already prepared that they are going to spend a certain amount of money. If you've done this and figured out what's going to happen when and what's, and you predict the future before it actually happens and you get your people ready for the future before it actually happens, then they get what they expect. They don't get surprises. They don't get emotional. They keep calm. So at the stage the repairs come in, it turns out to be less than 1%. Wow, well, this is better than what we penciled in. Then the buyer doesn't have the confrontation of the people saying, oh, no, we're not going to fix this, we're not going to fix that, and the buyer walks away. Instead, it stays smoother, it stays happier, and then right at the very closing, you can do whatever walkthrough needs to be done and finish things off and realize that there is going to be a moment right at the closing where they may question your repairs or your quality of the repairs. Of course, that's when I get into my favorite part. I'd rather give them money. if you give them a credit, they can do the repairs later. $4,326 is always $4,326, but whether you fix that kitchen sink properly is debatable. So that's one of my other techniques in terms of dealing with a game plan. Try to build in simple solutions where you don't have, you minimize the number of problems that can come up. But a game plan is something that from the very beginning to the very end gets your clients, either your buyers or your sellers, ready so they understand the entire process. They have expectations on the entire process. When you fulfill their expectations, you are a genius because you predicted the future.
I want to talk about one of your other strategies that I really like. And one of the most important ones is when one party asks for something, that you always get something in return. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Basically, if you keep giving and giving and giving, they're going to keep on asking and asking and asking. So when somebody calls up and says, oh, well, we need an extension on the period for the inspection for the repairs, if you just give them an extension, then they call up again and want another extension, they're going to keep on asking. If instead you say, yeah, we'll give you that. You need another week? Great. Well, the amount of money that you put up, as a part of, in our state, we have a thing called a due diligence payment. Other states have different things. The amount of money that you put up for that period of time was this, and you want another week? How much more are you going to offer me? So when they ask you for something, you ask them for something. This is critically important for those of you that have rental properties and you're dealing with tenants. If every time the tenant asks you do something, they keep on asking. If instead when they want something, then you get something, it kind of balances things out.
Now, Tim, another one of your strategies was to avoid hostile emotions. In fact, I love your analogy. Realtors are like a shock absorber. How can we go about keeping our emotions under control when things are, getting very hostile between the parties?
And this is absolutely critical because it's one of the big values that realtors bring. A lot of people predicted that realtors were going to go the way of travel agents. You know, when the internet came in, that all of a sudden the travel agents disappeared and they thought, oh yeah, there's all this information about the real estate. Realtors are still doing very well. And one of the services we provide is by making sure that everybody works together in a collaborative manner and keeps focused on one party is selling a house that they love and another party is buying a house that hopefully they will love. So when the other agent is ranting and raising their voice and doing all sorts of stuff and saying some things that are not particularly flattering about your clients, you're not obligated to pass that on. That's where the shock absorber concept comes in. You just absorb it, deal with it, smile, bite your lip on occasion. I love the thing that Thomas Jefferson said, that if you're angry, count to 10. If you're still angry, count to 100. I think Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, had a much better version. He said, if you're angry, count to 10. If you're still angry, swear. I don't recommend the swearing and that's the thing that I'm talking about here. Keep your emotions out of it, because if it gets emotional, it becomes a contest. If it gets to be something where they're angry at each other, then as opposed to focusing on that nice house and our nice new home and all the smooth transactions, then it's, I'm going to beat that person. I'm going to win this one. And then when they come up with the next one, I'm going to win that one. And I'm going to win this one. And I'm going to win that one. And it's nothing but hostile, 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 with the idea of all I want to do is win every single round of the transaction, as opposed to if you keep it less emotional and more favorable, then you're going to close it a lot more smoothly. Now, this is not to say you keep all emotions out of negotiations. You want to use positive emotions. You got to keep your buyer emotionally attached to that property and emotionally interested in all the benefits of having their children walk to the school that they really want to have their children go to when things get a little bit more difficult. So you keep the emotions in it, but you do not exchange unpleasant emotions. You don't get hostile with the other party. On occasion, you will have to have a little discussion. You're going to have to straighten them out, or you might have to back them down a little bit. But you try to do that in a professional manner, because if it deteriorates into I'm going to beat you and I'm going to out-yell you and I'm going to win, then it just gets miserable. Unfortunately, in the construction trade, I used to work with contractors. One of the things that they do is have found that whoever yells the loudest will win. That may work out on a construction site. It doesn't work in real estate.
I'm shifting gears now. Let's talk about choosing the prices that we want to make an offer at or that we want to counter at. Would you share your strategy about what works for you instead of just pulling like 140 or 150 as a round number?
Yeah, and I call it the PFA rule. You don't pull from air. So if you use a number in your negotiating process that looks as though you have no attachment to it, it's not that persuasive. Now, at the very beginning of setting a price, one of the things that determines how we set the price is the internet age. I'm going to set a property at 200 instead of 199 all day long, because somebody is searching from 150 to 200 and somebody else is searching from 200 to 250 on Zillow, Trulia, Realtor.com, and everything else. So those numbers, I do go with the round numbers. But once you start negotiating, you want to have your numbers have some credibility, and round numbers don't. So if, you know, you come down from 200 to 195, that's not that persuasive. You just pull that number out of the air. And there's two different parts to this. You don't pull from air, but you also make your numbers look better. The same thing they've been doing in grocery stores for centuries. If you're coming down on the seller's side and you were thinking about 195, you make it 194,875. Has a bunch of analysis in it, and that number has some credibility, and it sounds lower than 195. If you're representing a buyer and you were thinking of going to 195, you go to 195,376. And it's a little bit over it, but you show that you've analyzed these numbers in great detail, i.e., if this is the buyer, this is what they can actually afford. This particularly works very well on your last offer, on your last counter offer. People will think that you agonized over it and give it more credibility and accept it, as opposed to challenging it and trying to come back. Round numbers, pulled from air, easy to challenge. Something that is not round, that has a lot of credibility to it, a lot better way to wrap up a negotiation.
Tim, another recommendation that you have is to never split the difference. Now, are you talking about when you begin negotiation, how far you are into it? Why is that not a good idea?
Well, actually, on splitting the difference, it gives you a lot of information. And the point is, don't split the difference right at the beginning, because the other people will keep splitting the difference with you. But the first thing to learn from the opening point of negotiations is the vast majority of people will ultimately end up right in the middle. This came from Harvard Negotiating Project has done several studies, but my favorite was by an instructor who teaches lawyers to negotiate. And he had handed out the same factual situation thousands of times and had everybody keep track of where they started and where they ended up. And there was this huge bell curve, this giant spike right in the middle. So depending upon where one side started and the other side started, they almost always ended up right in the middle. So one of the things to take out of this concept that the majority of people will ultimately split the difference with you is when they're opening, your opening price is 200, their offer is 190, you're probably going to end up at 195 on their mind, that they are really signaling you that that's what they're willing to give you from their very opening offer. The part time when I do use split the difference is I love to use it at the end of a protracted negotiation. When everybody's getting tired, you need to add a little bit of humor. Try calling up the other party and saying, you know, we've gone back and forth seven times. Let's make both of our parties equally unhappy. We're aiming to get right here, and that's right where we are, halfway in between where we currently are. Let's split the difference and meet in the middle. However, let me give you a suggestion. And this is a different way that I use split the difference from most other people. I want them to suggest to my client that they will split the difference. So if I make the suggestion and say, I tell you what, you know, I'm at 197, you are at 193, we're going to end up at 195, it's going to take us six more times back and forth, we're both getting tired. Why don't you suggest that we split the difference at 195? If you will suggest it, I can guarantee you my people will take it. The reason you want to do that is if you be the one to suggest the splitting the difference and then they present it to their clients are going to say, that's a great concept. That's a really neat idea. They're at 195. We're at 193. We need to accept that idea. We want 194. Use it at the right moment. Don't do it right at the beginning, because it's a tool that you use when everybody's worn out. Right at the beginning, you split the difference, they're going to keep splitting the difference with you. You won't close it. But use the fact that it signals what they really mean by their opening offer, because then you can predict where you're going to end up. And if your clients are happy that you're going to end up there, all you got to do is go through the steps.
Okay, let's go on to another strategy, which you call the flinch. How do we use the flinch when we're negotiating?
And most of the time it has to be face-to-face. Most of the time it's something you do interpersonally. On occasion, you can do it over the phone, but you know, let's say you're doing a walkthrough on the property and somebody wants to buy the washer, dryer, and the refrigerator. And you ask them what they want for the washer, dryer, and the fridge, and they say $1,500. You immediately flinch. $1,500? You'll have to do better than that. Okay. How about $995? Okay. They countered their offer before you had to make them an offer. Now, if you want, you can counter their offer again and negotiate a little further. But a flinch is just a quick reaction. One of the more gentle ways, and I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina, it is the South. If you don't want to do what, you got to do better than that. One of the more gentle ways to come back to somebody is just to look at them with a puzzle and say, well, is that the best you can do? Keeps the emotional level down, but frequently they will do better than that after just that gentle little nudge. And you'll also be astounded at a lot of retail stores, places where the salespeople have discretion on what the pricing is. You're trying to negotiate a little something with them, throwing in the warranty and yada, yada, yada. If at that stage you say, is that the best you can do? They'll frequently pull out exactly what the best you can do is, and you will do that much better and do it fairly gracefully.
Yeah, one challenge that agents face when they're negotiating is when they receive a ridiculously low offer. A lot of people have different approaches for handling this situation. How do you handle it?
I look at all the three different choices because one of the simplest things that you can do is just flat out reject it. And one of the reasons you don't want to really give credibility to an opening offer is where somebody opens anchors the negotiations. They had a wonderful study by the Harvard Negotiating Projects that says the anchor really determines the outcome. So if you react in a manner that gives some credibility to that low opening offer, you're going to end up at a lower price. So one of the simplest things to do is just reject it. One of the problems with just rejecting it is it frequently results in the buyer just walking away. They figure you're not interested, you don't want to play, they go away. So choice one is just reject. Choice two is what I call a courtesy counteroffer, a lot more southern. It takes a lot more time to explain. You come back to them and say, you're not even in the ballpark. And normally, if I were up in different parts of the United States, I would just say flat out reject it. But welcome to the South. We're a lot nicer here. We're a lot more southern. We're a lot more genteel. And what we'd like to do is give you a courtesy counteroffer is something that shows we're interested in working with you, but you come off your price very little. Now, I've come off as little as $100. I've come off as little as $1,000. It really depends on what price point you're at. But just say, this is not an indication of our being stubborn on our price. This is just an indication that we want to gently throw the ball back in your court and have you come back. If you don't do the long explanation, then you have the problem I had with a lady who was a not very sophisticated realtor out of Arizona. She bought a few properties for their own investment purposes, and she came out here and gave me an offer of 119 on a property that was priced at 155. We had four other properties like it that had sold between 153 and 157. We were well priced. But I did a courtesy counteroffer, came down very slowly, in a very small amount, and she was incensed. What? You're only coming off by this? And I just bit my lip to not blast her on her opening offer. So if you're going to do the courtesy counteroffer, take some time. The third thing is something I really enjoy, but it doesn't work, but it's so much fun. If they've got an offer that has a low price and then ridiculous terms, okay, it's contingent on us selling a house that's not fixed up yet, it's not on the market, and it's in an area where houses don't sell well. Go back to them and raise your price. Tell them, if you want those terms, then the price is going to be this, because price and terms are interrelated. If they want their terms, then you should have your price. I've tried it a couple of times just for grins on properties that I owned. Haven't been willing to do that on properties where I represent clients. Hasn't worked either time, but I really enjoyed it. It's kind of a fun thing to do.
And I've done that in the past, and when I've received a very low offer and my sellers were so incensed and they were really angry with me, and you want to deflect that. So what you did, what I did is I said, you can counter over asking price if you want. They said, we can't. And boy, they were so happy. It just changed the whole dynamic.
And the perfect use of the no hostile emotions. You got the hostility out of it from the very beginning, and then you could begin the process very well. So, yeah, great idea.
Yeah, you get them to laugh. That's the whole thing. Now, Tim, you mentioned this client who gave you this ridiculously low offer at 119 on a property should have been at 155. You did, and you talk about not giving those low offers credibility. Would you elaborate exactly on how you go about doing that?
And basically, it's just in your response. And the only way that you can show the lack of credibility is either, as we said, reject it. So that if you take the 119 and just say you're not even in the ballpark, we're not going to begin negotiations at that point. so that they don't get their expectations up that they're going to get it someplace in the 120s when in reality it's going to be in the 150s. And to a certain extent, you may be totally wasting your time. You know, if you lose something that's never going to come together, then there's no great loss. But my own personal preference is that courtesy counteroffer where you come in and say, I don't want to show any credibility on the part of your offer, but I want to work with you. And I think you've shown some respect. You like the house. I shouldn't be mad at you. You're making me an offer. I should be mad at all the other people that spent a whole lot of time going through the drawers and checking out the house, and they didn't make me an offer. So, yeah, you made me an offer. That's nice. Appreciate your work. However, we're not really going to be in the ballpark, so why don't I come off just a hair so you can have something to take back to your clients, indicate to them that we really aren't going to be interested anywhere close to your offer. You're going to have to come up dramatically the next time. Otherwise, we are just going to reject it. But let's work together, and here's something that we're giving you just out of courtesy.
And you have a really interesting approach to dealing with sellers that may be in a distressed property situation or with investors, and you call this the package option. Exactly how does that work?
You give people at least two different choices. And they get so busy focusing on the two different choices, they don't realize that there's an infinite number of other choices, because nobody says they have to pick your first, you know, item from column A or your second item from column B. An illustration is, if they really are in trouble, you'll tell them, fine, I'll buy this property for cash. We'll close in 10 days. That'll be well before your foreclosure process, and this will get you out of it. Or B, if you need more money, I'm going to need more time to get a loan on the property, and we will close substantially later, and we're going to have to work together and get the foreclosure postponed. A lot of times what will happen is that people will focus on one or the other, and this gets them just to focus on some of the two choices. A big percentage of the time, they're going to take the best of both worlds. They will take the higher finance price and the quicker cash close. So when you make a package option presentation, realize that a high percentage of the time your responses are going to be the best of both worlds. So before you make that offer, talk with your clients and see if they're willing to go for the best of both worlds. If they are, this is a great tool, because if they pick one or the other, hurrah, fabulous. If they take the best of both worlds, still good. You got a deal put together.
Tim, one of the concepts that you talk about in Create a Great Deal is the longer the individual negotiates with you, the less likely they are to walk away. How do I navigate that process when we've been negotiating back and forth to my advantage?
When I used to work in Southern California 20 years ago, we would frequently go back and forth and back and forth many, many, many times. One of the things I learned is if somebody stayed in negotiation an extended period of time, they weren't going to walk. They were really committed to completing the negotiation, partly because they spent all this time negotiating. And if they walked, they wasted all their time. Having a deal is a success. They've accomplished something. Having no deal, they wasted their time. So one of the things that I do is I come down less and less and less and less every step that I take, so that it signals that I'm getting closer and closer to my bottom line. But also I take advantage of the fact that now I know they're not walking. If we're on our 7th, 8th, 9th counteroffer, they're not going someplace else. They're just trying to gild the lily. They're looking to make something a little bit better for them. And really, they want the house, and they're going to go ahead and complete the process anyway. So I get more and more and more, at least I recommend to my clients that they get more and more and more stubborn, so that it signals we're just about done. The other thing that it does, particularly if I'm representing sellers, the buyers have to worry that somebody else might come along. And if they're getting less and less every single time they come back, they have to worry that somebody else is going to ride in like the cavalry at the 11th hour and suddenly rescue my sellers and offer them way more money, and they're not going to get the deal that they've just about negotiating. So when you have an extended, protracted negotiation, one of the things that you've got to realize when you're on either side of it, the other people aren't walking. You can get more and more stubborn, and they'll put the deal together.
Tim, to wrap up, could you summarize kind of your takeaway about what negotiation is really about?
It's the big, big value that realtors bring to the transaction. Decades ago, when I started, the value that realtors brought is we had the information. We had the listing book. We don't anymore. The thing that we now have is the negotiating talent, the ability to put deals together and keep them together. Negotiating is fascinating. It is a wonderful art based upon understanding who the people you're working with are, communicating particularly well, finding out everybody's values, and getting at least two people, frequently more, to accept something other than what they originally thought they wanted. And that's the essence of negotiating. Gradually persuading people that they started from one position, they ended up in another position, and they're happy. So it's a method of working together with people so they all collaborate, we all get to a positive result, and hopefully we've had a good time.
Tim, thank you. This has been an excellent interview. We've been visiting with Tim Burrell. He's an agent with RE/MAX United in Raleigh, North Carolina. He's the author of Create a Great Deal. Thanks for being with us today, Tim.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
This is Bernice Ross, and thank you for joining us for MN Real Estate Radio. Be sure to tune in next Thursday when we'll be back with the industry's movers and shakers to learn what's next for real estate. For more insight, news, and analysis, visit MN.com. Make it a great day.